Okay, yeah, thanks a lot for the opportunity to present the work. So, looking back, it's already a number of years that I'm concerned with this subject, collaboration with Sergei Ayokin, Johannes Greenlein, and a lot of other friends. We produced a number of papers over the years. So we are contributing to knowledge about PDFs, and this is the current PDF landscape. You know, we have a string landscape, this is the PDF landscape. There are currently certain active groups. We are one of them, and there is CJ, this is a Jefferson CJ collaboration, and there is CJ collaboration. There is a group at HERA PDFs, there is JFR from Korea, there is UK group, which is now MMHT, so this is Martin, Martininski, Holland, Lang, and Thorne, and there is the NMPF group. So they're all looking at data and trying to come up with predictions for the proton content of the proton. And they pretty much use all available data, so in this table we try to sort of summarize a bit very sketchily what kind of data these fits are being based on. So you see, the backbone of these fits is always inclusive DIS data, and then you have to supplement this data by data from other colliders that allow you to do flavor separation, for instance, for the proton content in the proton, so that you can separate U, D, strange, and so on and so forth. And some groups then add other data, for instance, jet data, to get additional information on nuance. Sometimes some just charm data is added. It depends. Another thing which distinguishes various approaches is the statistical approach. There is what is called as the delta chi-square criteria. That's a problem when you have different data sets from different experiments. Then sometimes you discover you want to include them in a fit, but they're not compatible. You can fit the one data set, you can fit the other data set, but somehow together they are incompatible. And then one thing is, one approach is, are you willing to pay a penalty in your chi-square analysis by including two incompatible data sets? And some of the groups do so, yeah, so they are willing to pay a penalty in the chi-square by combining two data sets which are obviously incompatible, and other groups which say they don't want to pay a penalty, they keep to this strict delta chi-square people one criterion, so there should not be any change in the chi-square in the best fit between the two individual data sets when you combine them. They choose to discard an incompatible data set. And of course, this is a long, this is a tedious work in order to find out that whenever you include some new data sets, whether it's compatible or whether there's some problems.
So does NMPDF, that group, they have delta chi-square just one.
Yeah.
Do they toss out some data that they don't want?
There is, for instance, so CTEC uses, for instance, some old CDHS data, which is known to have problems, and this is disregarded by everybody else. So they have selected, they make selections on the data set as well. Okay, so that's the landscape. This is where we're starting from, and you see it's an active field. We have a lot of fun, and in order to advise experimentalists, three of the groups got together at the end of last year and issued some recommendations. They issued the archive in October with the title DFRHC recommendations for round two. So they were issued by CTEC, MMHT, and NMPDF, and they advise experiments to use their sets, or if the experiments should be sufficient. Efficient, they should use some sort of average set which is based on the three sets. So there has been an averaging procedure devised combining all the PDF sets of these three groups, and you get you can download this average set. And this is what's being advised by those people. And we said, well, lo and behold, one can take a different attitude. So we came up with recommendations for PDF usage and IHC predictions, and that was then recommendations by us, our colleagues, And we published a paper earlier last month, and we try to simplify things. But I mean, first of all, our attitude is nobody, we are old enough, so we don't need recommendations. So we try to simplify the recommendations a bit, to the extent that if you're after precision theory predictions, you know, then you're calculating typically high orders, you want to have a very precise result, and most likely the final cross-section that you get out will depend on what type of PDF you're choosing. Yeah? So the recommendation is you should choose not some average where you don't know what went in, but choose any of the individual ones, or as many as possible, if your computational resources allow you to do so, and just check the sensitivity of your results to the chosen input parameters, like the PDF, alpha S, log masses, and so on. Yeah? So this is our approach, and basically it says, educate yourself, look at what kind of product you're buying, read the fine print, and then use it. Yeah? There are also other theory predictions, you know. I mean, suppose you just want to run a Monte Carlo, you want to have a back of an envelope estimate, something like this. And if you're not really caring about high precision, then any of the sets which are listed in this LHAPDF library are fine. Yeah? And you should stick to version 6. Because that excludes a few of these sets with outdated calibration. So one of the sets with outdated calibration you can get from Physics Letters 1986 from this pocket protonometer by John Ralston. So there you have to know how to use a slide ruler because it's based on solving the Dirac evolution and in a double logarithmic approximation. I checked it once, the calibration is still good to order 50% or so, but if we want to be better, then we should not use this anymore. Okay, so if we try to determine PDFs, then of course we work in collinear factorization. So these are the objects that we want to extract, for instance, from cross-sections and protocol colliders, and this is what we have to provide. This is the theory predictions to typically next to leading order in order to have precise enough predictions. And then once we have these predictions, we compare the data and extract the PDFs. So, and a nice thing to illustrate the problems that we're currently facing is the Higgs boson cross-section. This is known to very high accuracy. So going back to the first complete analog QCD correction, to a paper by Spielmann, Giardi, Gaudenz, and Servas more than 20 years ago, when they completed the analog QCD corrections, they came up with a plot like this. Back then, the Higgs mass range was still a bit larger than it is now. And they were using PDFs that went under names of MRS, GRV, whatever. Doesn't really matter, but in their paper, they quoted that after completing the analog QCD computations, that one of the main uncertainties is the gluon density, and that they find a variation of about 7% just checking the different sets that were available at that time. No? So that was 20 years ago. Now we scroll fast forward to 2016. We have two more orders in perturbation theory. Very stable predictions at n cubed LO. If you look at the scale variation, I think that has been discussed at length at this workshop. We can even convince ourselves that if we estimate n to the fourth LO predictions, everything is under control on the side of the hard cross-section. And then we just stick in different PDFs. You know, we just take all the seven sets, and we make predictions at NNLO, yeah, because the n-cubed LO code is not fully public yet. So for the sake of the argument, it doesn't really matter. It just tells you that using these seven different sets off the shelf, you get cross-section values for the Higgs cross-section at 13 TeV at NNLO, which show you a spread between 38 picoborn and 42.6 picoborn, which is about 11%. And this is much, much larger than the residual scale uncertainty that we currently see when looking at the accuracy with which we know the high.
The errors in the numbers are
simply PDF uncertainty. So it's all at the nominal scale, right? It's all at the nominal scale, and the errors are just now showing you the PDF uncertainties. And it shows you a large spread, and what I find a bit worrisome is that currently these Higgs cross-section working groups at the LHC, they're preparing their yellow report number 4, and they are basing their predictions entirely on this PDF value for LHC 15 set, which is the average of this, this, and this.
And this is the number they are quoting, and this is also the uncertainty they will be quoting. Yeah? And this certainly doesn't cover the spread in predictions that we observe. This is mostly only PDF uncertainties. Alpha S is fixed in all of the groups except we fit alpha S along, and so in our uncertainty there is the uncertainty on alpha S that we get from the experimental precision of the
data. So you use the same alpha S for every set, not the recommended ones?
No, this is just a nominal alpha S that you get with every set, and I think I have a later slide that I can show you the alpha S values in some later slide. But it's basically over here, and here. It's 0.118. And JR fit alpha S, we fit alpha S, we get values of alpha S of the order of 0.114, roughly. Here our PDF also fits alpha S at NLO, they get at NLO 1180. This is also what we find at NLO, but at NMLO the difference is there.
So the difference in the central values is mainly 251?
Not entirely, no. This is what I want to show in the next couple of slides. Yeah? So this is just to set the stage.
Look at the kind of distribution of these values, though. There's a whole set that are fairly tightly clustered, and then there's two outliers.
Right, this is a good, this is a valid observation, so I just want to discuss a bit what, how can we explain these values, what are the problems, So if you bear with me for a couple of minutes, then I'll try to illuminate this a bit further, So, just short recap, if you do these global fits, this is an example of the data sets that go into our fit, so inclusive BIS data. This is of the order of 2,700 data points. Then you have charm data, which is essential from DAS. You use Relgan data. You use LHC data for W and Z boson production between the nuclear and DAS for the strangeness separation. So with this data set, you can disentangle the flavor content of the proton as well. And then you start your iterative cycle. As I said, you should always check compatibility of the data sets. You look at new constraints, whether any of the data sets give you better constraints, and then you perform the extraction of PDFs and other parameters. Yeah? And the product kinematics that we're covering is basically with respect to the LHC. It's kind of displayed here. So this is X versus Q squared. And you see here in this lower triangle, we have the AS data from fixed target from HERA. They populate an X range between roughly 0.5 and down to a few times 10 to the minus 5 over here. And this covers the X range, which is currently probed at the LHC, so at lower scales, and you have to run the evolution to transport your results from here to there. So, in terms of particle kinematics, I would say we are covered and we can make precise predictions for the LHC.
Can you go back two slides? I mean, I was just wondering, in your list, where are you really sensitive to the gluons?
To the gluons, we're sensitive basically here, and to some extent here with the DAS data. We're sensitive.
So, it only comes in at the next to leading order that you're. So even in the next to next to leading order calculation, you're only sensitive to gluons at next to leading order.
I wouldn't phrase it this way because basically when you fit your DAS cross section, you always fit the whole cross section, not just the structure function, and this includes the transverse and the longitudinal part. And for instance, the longitudinal part already at leading order is sensitive to the gluon. You cannot really. Argue in the way that you've just said. So you try to parameterize the full DAS cross-section, correct, to next to next to leading order. And on top of that, of course, you also have to include power corrections, target mass corrections, in order to be sure that you cover the relevant kinematics in your X and Q squared plane.
What I'm saying is in DIS, I mean, the gluons only enter at order alpha S.
The gluons enter through the Wilson coefficient, so they are probed or the Wilson coefficient, and they are there in order alpha s correction, right? This is correct. And order alpha s correction to the Wilson coefficient, however, it's charming. I mean, you're directly sensitive to the gluon at leading order already. Yeah? So this is boson gluon fusion. Yeah?
Okay.
Yeah. And this we also treat to NNO. Okay, theory considerations I think which are important are that you should work with strictly NNLO, because of the theoretical uncertainties. You should choose a consistent scheme for the treatment of the heavy quarks, and you should choose consistent data sets, and you should take full account of error correlations, and then whatever you get out is, of course, the result of an interplay with the assumptions and perturbation theory that you made when you these bits. So I'll show you some examples. So the benchmark measurements which are available to NNLO in DIS are the structure functions. So the light quark structure functions, they're known to very high accuracy. Also the heavy quark structure functions are known. So not fully exact to NNLO, there are some approximate expressions to NNLO which can be used on charged current DIS, and most recently something that has also been reported here last week, Stargate production in DIS. So there are the first results, and of course that will be interesting to also include Stargate DIS data, because this will give you a different correlation between the DIS data with respect to alpha s and
equilibrium. Can you remind us, for the Dirichlet data, I remember the quality of the data is not at the same level as for inclusive DIS.
This is what they are currently looking at, so it basically requires another layer of analysis now, going back to the data, looking at the quality of the data, and then trying to see whether this is additional constraints. So I would say this is a very interesting development, which we certainly like to put in, but I cannot say anything more than this at the moment. And from the LHC, we have available W and Z boson production data, also fully differential. Halo production of top-quark pairs is available, and halo production of jets is work in progress. And single top of course also. So these are the important processes which give you then additional constraints from the LHC on your.
So you don't include the jets because it's.
At the moment, we personally are not including the jets in our fit because they are only available to NLO, so you have large scale uncertainties, and we're not sure about the K factor that we see once the full NNLO QCD corrections are completed. If you do, we did it. We have a couple of publications where we looked at the effect of jet data in our fit, and we see that, of course, it has a direct impact on the gluon distribution. It shifts and on the value of alpha s, because it's basically alpha s squared times the quarter luminosities. And so you have to be really very sure that your theory description is accurate enough before you want to introduce additional shifts there.
You could include it with some theory error.
Yeah, but it doesn't add anything. So we would enlarge the theory error, and then it doesn't become predictive. You know, we would include them. The theory uncertainty would be that size, and then whatever we get as a position from your RDS, it would be within this uncertainty band. Yeah? So we're not in contradiction. It's just that at the moment, with the current theory, it doesn't add anything at all.
Are you sure that you just the alpha s move? Just the closer to the.
Well, basically, when you include jet data from the Tevatron, there was a bit of push up by one sigma. So this is what we've observed. Nothing dramatic, but somewhere in that range. Yeah.
And do you include this actually in your error estimation in the end, or your uncertainty estimation?
What?
The upshift of alpha s?
What we include in the uncertainty that we quote on all the parameters, we include as an uncertainty estimate the propagated experimental uncertainties. Yeah? So you have some data with some errors, These uncertainties on the experimental data are then propagated into the final numbers, and so for alpha s, it gives us an alpha s value, for instance, from our fit at NLO, which is 1180 with an error of 0.1 on the third digit, and at NNLO it goes down due to the larger k factors that you have here in DLS. We get something in the range 1130-1140, also with the same.
Okay, then a
point about the ansatz. So what most of the groups do is they take some polynomial ansatz at low scales, yeah, which has of the order of between 20 and 30 parameters. So this is fully sufficient. Data at the moment cannot constrain more than that parameters. There is the exception of NNPDF, the use of the order of 260 parameters to fit the PDFs, but this is due to a very different parameterization approach. So in each order of magnitude in X between, say, 10 to the minus 1 and 10 to the minus 2 in X, and so on and so forth, we parameterize all the PDFs with 4 parameters, and then 13 times 4 times 6 for 6 decades in X. It gives you of the order 260 parameters, but actually you can do with less if you take smooth polynomial parameterizations. Whenever you include Noether sets, of course you can enlarge your fit ansatz a bit. You add one or two more parameters here in your polynomials, and you see whether you're sensitive and whether your fit forces you to extend this. Yeah? So this is typically a sanity check that we're doing, and. Then when you run your fit and you're done, you can check your covariance matrix. So we always check that it's positive definite. We don't always put them in the paper. So here in ABM 11, we once put them in the paper. It's a big table. And then you see, for instance, I don't know, how alpha s is correlated with some of the gluon parameters over here. So this is the stronger anti-correlation, less correlation with other parameters. But you can check it all and read it off. Huh? And this is the results that you're getting. So power distributions for top row is U-valence, and bottom row is for the gluon at two different scales. So this is at the scale of Q squared equal 4 GeV. This is at the scale of this is D-valence, and this is the C. This is also at 4 GeV. And there you see sometimes, like for the U-valence, the fits all agree, because this is fitting the absolute normalization of the AS data, for instance. So this is very well constrained through the absolute normalization of your DAS data. And then for the D valence, you see sometimes that differences. This then rests on the flavor separation. How well can you separate U from the D? And there you need additional information from other sources. So if you see the HERA PDF result, which is this light blue band, this is much different from other determinations. There, for instance, using HERA data only, and this gives them less constraints on the D separation. So they're getting different results. And then also down here, you see that the gluon at low scales and small x, this is definitely different between some of the groups. And this is CTEC, MMHT, and NNPDF. This is a similar thing. So you also see here again for the gluon at low X, you see significant or really large uncertainties. But from those plots, you cannot really tell much. So you really have to go to cross sections and compare with data in order to draw your conclusions. And in order to come back to this issue of the Higgs cross section and the differences we are seeing there, we need to look into the treatment of heavy quarks and deep inelastic scattering. We need to look into this part of the theory predictions that go into data to see what the different groups are doing there in order to see why the results are what they are. Yeah? So typically you have light quarks and heavy quarks. Yeah? If you compare the quark mass to the QCD scale, typically light quarks would be UD and strange. So this would be the three light flavors, and then charm, bottom, and top, these are the heavy flavors. and we know from QCD very well how we can match theories with different flavors. You just do a matching calculation, and for alpha s, what happens, so this is documented here in this PDG plot, alpha s running over a large range of scales, and this includes matching from 3 to 4 to 5 flavors in the running, and if you zoom in, and you see here what the matching does, if you come from 3 to 4 flavors, you have a slight discontinuity here for bottom again. So there is, this is the result of the matching computation, but we know how to do this to, I think, up to 4 loop order. Now the same thing you can do for PDFs with once you cross a flavor threshold. So suppose you're doing a fit with only up, down, and strange, and at some point you want to generate charm. Then this is the same matching formula that you can derive from QCD in order to generate any heavy flavor distribution in your NF light flavor was just one heavy flavor theory. And it just tells you that when you want to generate, for instance, charm here, then you take it out of the gluon and out of the C quarks, from convolution with the operator matrix elements A. So these heavy quark operator matrix elements you can calculate in perturbation theory. And this is like the one loop result here. This is what you would calculate for one loop. In the expansion for the heavy quark gluon operator matrix element, you see a log of the scale over M times the PQG splitting function, and the constant term X leading order is simply zero. It's absent, and you stick it in, then your charm density from this general matching prescription would be calculated at some matching scale, calculated simply from the convolution of your leading order quark gluon splitting function with gluon distribution, and then times a log here, the relevant scale, and that's it. This is what you do at a matching scale, and the presence of this log and the absence of this constant term tells you that at leading order this matching is smooth, because at leading order this damage is set. Now if you do this to higher order, say to NLO, then this is the same schematic expression here. You have constant term and two powers, two terms of logarithmic powers. And now the constant term over here is not zero anymore. So you expect to see jumps in your heavy quark distributions in the same way as you've seen jumps there in the alpha S running that I showed you before. And this is what you see actually. So this is now for the charm and the bottom distributions generated perturbatively by going from 3 to 4 flavors and from 4 to 5 flavors. And in particular, this constant term that in the two-loop operator matrix elements, this is negative. So if this is the matching scale here, then you see there is a slight negative, a slight range of Q squared where your charm contribution is actually negative. And you need a while to evolve it to become positive. And that you see here in the discontinuity of the gluon distribution, because this is where you take the momentum from. So you have your jump, the gluon is a bit large, and then it levels off. And you see over the whole range of scales that the gluon is becoming a bit smaller and smaller compared to as you would evolve as if you would keep it in the three-flavor scheme. Because you have to take the momentum for the charm and for the bottom then out of the gluon. But this is, you can control this all in perturbation theory, and this is fine. And then you can choose when you want to describe your heavy quark DIS data, you can choose how do you want to implement this in cross-section. And there are basically two different choices what you can do. The one thing is you can do a so-called fixed flavor number scheme, and that can be summarized as far as follows. You just keep all the logarithms in Q squared over M squared at fixed order. This is, I would say, pretty much standard what we're doing also at the LHC. So when we're considering top quark production at the LHC, a single top production, this is done in a four-flavor scheme or in a five-flavor scheme, where we keep the number of flavors fixed. We just decide beforehand how many flavors do we have, and then we keep it fixed and do our predictions. Now the argument has been that because DIS data covers a large range of scales, one should actually resum these logarithms. And this leads to a so-called variable flavor number scheme. And what you need to do is,
you need to achieve a matching of two distinct theories at the level of cross-sections. So this is difficult, and this is what something you cannot really achieve from first principles quantum field theory anymore. So at this level, some phenomenology comes in, and for the Hadron Collider, an equivalent thing has been discussed, for instance, in this paper on the Santander matching for Higgs production from PV bar annihilation, where people suggested some way of matching four flavor and five flavor schemes over PT of the Higgs boson, or PT range of the Higgs boson with each other. But this is there is phenomenology entering at this level and modeling assumptions. I'll show you in a minute. And now when people look at heavy quark diagnostic scattering data object era, there are different incarnations of these world of flavor number schemes because there is no unique prescription. And this is why there are so many different choices. There is ACOT, there is BMSN, there is RT, there is funnel, and they all differ in various ways they implement their modeling assumptions here. Just as a remark, of course, we did a statistical check whether one should actually follow this hypothesis of resumming the large logs, whether there are any indications in the data. And you can check this by looking at the DIS data, for instance, over the entire range in Q squared where it has been taken. And you look at the result of the fit, and you look at the pools. So you see how much data is above and below the fit, and then you can parameterize the pools that you derive in terms of a constant plus a slope in Q squared, just to be sure statistically that you don't miss any large logarithms. And this is the results that we see when we fit for those data, the constant and the slope, and in particular the slope here over a whole range of kinematics for every bin in X where we can cover a range of Q squared values. You see there is no indication for any non-zero slope within the experimental uncertainties.
So I'm a little confused. If you use the five-flavor number scheme, which I guess you do sometimes, then your B-quark distribution is obeying the full evolution equation, is it not?
Well, you need to distinguish. I mean, our B-quark distribution, which we're generating here, this is what we're generating this as a result of a fit, which we've been doing in a fixed flavor number scheme where we keep NF equals 3 fixed for DAS data. We, of course, when we include top data, we keep NF equals 5 for the top part, but we always keep NF fixed in our cross-section predictions. Nevertheless, I've just shown you, you can always generate your B-quark distribution just by following the normal matching procedure.
Right, but once you've matched it, then the B-quark distribution, the five-flavor B-quark distribution evolves according to
Absolutely. The five-flavor B-quark distribution evolves according to the normal D-club evolution. So you generate it like here, and then you evolve it with the normal NNOO D-club evolution. It's just that in the cross-sections themselves, in the part which is connected to the Wilson coefficient, we don't resum them. This is the difference, And this is what those verbal flavor number schemes do, because they try to resum these logs by modeling the Wilson coefficient of the hot scattering. So we see in the fixed flavor number scheme approach, we see no indications, but nevertheless one can check what's going on with some variable flavor numbers implementation, and this is what I'll show you in a minute. So all the variable flavor number schemes that are devised, they work as follows. This is for the example of this B and this N approach, but funnel works in a similar way. You want to have a cross-section structure function, whatever, which smoothly interpolates between NF and NF plus 1. So at low scales, you take the exact result for your heavy quark prediction. So this would be the massive heavy quark structure function, which includes all the mass effects and which has three light quarks and a heavy one. So this would be OK at low scales. And then you want to approach asymptotically at high scales
what I call here the zero mass variable flavor number scheme. This is the completely massless calculations, which then has NF plus one active flavors and no mass effects anymore. So you somehow want to come from here to here in a smooth way, and you simply add them up, but you have to subtract the double counting, namely all the large logarithms that are already contained in here and which you want to take out here. So you have to subtract the asymptotic expansion of your heavy quark result. So these are the three ingredients, and this is for all the schemes that are being devised the same. The trouble is that when you write down the difference, there is no clear recipe as how you should treat it. And this is the modeling part that comes in, because you require that there is a smooth continuation, and that this part here, whatever you have added here, that this vanishes at low scales when your result is completely massive and you're happy with that. So the requirement all these variable flavor number schemes have to fulfill is that these curly bracket, term in curly brackets, that has to vanish at low Q squared, or Q squared of the order of the heavy quark mass. This is where the modeling comes in, because there all the details that are being used in these model schemes, they vary very much. For instance, the ACOT scheme, it forces this term to vanish, or its onset to be delayed to very high scales by just rescaling phenologically the x parameter by this value chi squared, where you basically you defer the onset of this term. In the funnel approach, they just kill this term close to threshold by adding a damping factor, for instance. In the RT scheme, they treat this term in a similar way by modeling smoothness in the transition region. And there is no recipe in QCD or quantum field theory that would tell you how you should justify all these prescriptions here. So this is the modeling part that I was mentioning before. We did, in some earlier study, we implemented this PMSM scheme. And this is just showing you the result here for the charm structure function to see what's happening. So the blue curve here is the exact massive three flavor number scheme. This is the blue curve here. And the green curve, and then the red curve is the result of this variable flavor number scheme, which is interpolating between the two regions here. Now you see the difference between the blue curve and the red curve up here. You have to look at the slope, and the slope is almost the same but not quite, because here you're lacking one power in NF, one factor, basically the addition of NF plus one factor multiplying one logarithm. So if you plotted the slope here, then the green curve would have a bit steeper slope than the blue curve. But the important thing is, if you look at the region where data is, data is sitting at low scales, and it's not really probing the region of high Q squared, where you could distinguish between the two slopes. So this is again an explanation as to why when we check the poles, we don't really see any deviations. But the main differences here between the different schemes now comes here from the threshold region. Because here, this is now the red curve here, and the precise transition from the blue curve to the green curve, this is the result of the modeling that we're doing here. And because this is in the region of data, this does have an impact on what you're getting out from your fit results.
So is this the main data now for heavy quark production that determines, that gives you additional information on the gluons, or?
This gives you additional information on the gluons, it gives you information on the charm quark mass, and it adds to the results of your fit, of course.
Because I'm just looking at the experimental errors there. If I read it correctly, you have your order 20%, 20% errors.
This is older data. I'll have newer data in a minute. I mean, this is just to show you the theory plots. The newer data is a bit more precise. I'll show you.
Are they really? So the different approaches, do they really give? I mean, you would kind of assume that they all lie somewhere in between the blue and the green curve, right?
What kind of difference?
I mean, like the different matching.
They're all different.
I mean, I find it hard I mean, if I see how close the green and the blue are in that region, I find it hard to believe that different approaches would give wildly different answers.
We're talking in the end, you see, I mean, we're talking on the Higgs cross-section, we're talking a spread of 11% in total, and we have to look really at the fine details in order to see where the individual percents are coming from. Huh?
Okay, so there was the same for the
bottom on the other slide. An additional uncertainty related to this threshold region is now if we look at the Charnock density, at the log derivative of the Charnock density, what we once treated in fixed order perturbation theory, that means we just use this decoupling relation to generate it at some scale, and we look at the result of the evolution. Yeah? And this is shown for three different bins in X, smaller X and larger X's. And this is shown to different orders in perturbation theory, how you can actually generate this charm quark density. So you could do it in leading order, just using the leading order operator matrix elements with precisely the formula I had on a couple of slides ago. And then you see at threshold there is smooth matching, and then there is some finer difference between looking at the charm quark distributions in fixed order and evolving it to leading order. Huh? But of course we want to go to higher order precision, so we could do it consistently at next to leading order. We can look at this difference between fixed order perturbation theory and evolution exact at next to leading order, where we use the next to leading order heavy quark operator matrix and elements and next to leading order evolution consistently. And this is this blue curve everywhere. And the important thing is here, if you look, the arrow here that gives you the region of data which is being covered. Yeah. So we are always sitting in a region, except for very large X, we're sitting in a region very close to threshold where the details of this heavy quark operator matrix elements matter. And now we can do something which is called NLO star. Here we can use next to leading order heavy quark operator matrix elements and NLO evolution. Yeah. And asymptotically, this gives you the same, so the red and the blue curve, they are the same asymptotically, but you see in the threshold region, precisely where we have data, there are big differences, and these are perturbative uncertainties related to the fact that at the moment, we don't have fully exact expressions for these heavy quark operator matrix elements at NLO. So this is an additional intrinsic uncertainty which actually should be added to these verb flavor number schemes when doing this procedure. Huh?
Okay, so how does it compare? So
verb flavor number schemes have some problems, and whenever you commit a crime, there is a price you have to pay. Yeah, and the price you have to pay can be isolated in the value of the charm quark mass that is used in the different theory descriptions. And this has been nicely summarized in an H1 and Zeus study, where they just took all the different theory predictions, they took their data, and they looked for the best fit in the value of the charm quark mass. And from this plot, you see that you have very nice chi-square parabola, so the data is actually able to constrain the value of the charm quark mass, but the values are very much different. So they range from something like 1.1 GeV up to 1.7 GeV, depending on what kind of theory scheme you're using.
A little bit, so where is this sigma of this parabola? Still a flat, so what's the error maybe you would quote with the stars?
The uncertainty which you typically get out of here from the experimental data is of the order of 100 MeV. So this is basically like 100 MeV is about this size. Yeah. This is typically what you get out.
Okay. So basically, the upper four points are consistent, and the one point at 1.1 has a problem, or there's a problem, an inconsistency.
I would
phrase it differently in a minute. So you can now take,
this is now the most accurate recent data. You can compare all these different heavy quark schemes to data, and this is what you're getting. For instance, for fixed flavor number schemes from us and from JR, this also gives you an idea about the experimental and the theory uncertainty and the experimental uncertainty. And of course, the theory uncertainty, this is adding, this is not only coming from this particular data set, this is coming from the global fit. Yeah? And then this is the same for HERA PDF. Yeah? You see, for instance, differences between NLO and NNLO here at low scales. At higher scales, things become better. And then this is for CTEC, MMHT, and LNPDF. And you see that, for instance, the ACOD scheme of CTEC, this has really problems in coming close to the data at all values of Q. So here it is down here, so it is very different. And here it is slowly moving up, but it's always way below the data. This is of the order, this is a discrepancy of the order of 40%, 30-40%. And now,
the prescription to get the uncertainty bands?
The uncertainty bands is simply PDF uncertainties. Yeah? From every of these, from each of the sets, you take the PDF uncertainties, you calculate them, and you just plot what you get for this particular observable. This can be very nicely done with this XFitter tool. So this is all the different theory versions implemented, and with a click on a button, you can just check the predictions and also check the chi score.
So why are these then much more conservative than what you had in JR and ABM? What's the box?
If you want to enlarge your uncertainties, this is towards smaller x values. Yeah? And this basically has to do with the way they do a parameterization in the small x region here, starting from 10 to the minus 3 down to 10 to the minus 4. If you go back to the PDF plots I had in the very early slides, you saw there were differences in the way uncertainties are being modeled or assumed also in the small x region, yeah, which is not necessarily always covered by the data uncertainty. So you would say here, compare the red with the black uncertainty bands, you would say there is room for improvement, for instance.
So I'm interested to understand the conclusion from this. So these are all variable
flavors.
Yeah. So and the green and blue are not doing so badly. It's just the ACOT.
Right. This is, for instance, you would say there is room for improvement. Huh?
So is the difference because of the different charm or
No, not necessarily. This is this ACOT scheme which they're using, yeah. And this chi-square, this low rescaling, this doesn't really capture, this doesn't model the cross-section very well. You know, after all, the philosophy behind this chi-square rescaling is some leading order kinematics assumption, and it simply doesn't work if you include higher order QCD corrections. Yeah, this is the main problem there.
Do they include this? Are they fitting this data?
They're fitting the data, yeah. They're fitting the data, of course. This data has been made cut, yeah. So this, they make a general cut to Q squared equal to 5. So they're fitting actually this data bin. Yeah.
So not the left data, but the right data?
Not the left, but the right, yeah.
Okay. And now comes one of the problems with this average set.
So if you take this PDF for LHC average set, This is the average of PDFs which has been determined either with ACOT, RT, or funnel. Yeah? And now you can take this average set, but you don't really know should you run it with the ACOT variable flavor number scheme, with RT, or with funnel. And so if you just check all of them, this is the range of predictions that you get. And this is the principal problem which is behind averaging. You know, it's just an illustration that when you use any of these averaged sets, you have no control about the theory assumptions anymore that went into this. Yeah. Okay. Now the problem with the Chan-Quark mass is, you were saying that on the previous plot some of them look consistent and others look inconsistent. Now, the way we would phrase it is the following. First of all, in this table we could just check the chi-square values when comparing it to data. And we see that, for instance, these fixed flavor number schemes with 65 over 52 data points, they're sort of okay. And they're certainly better than any of the variable flavor number schemes that are being used here, like MMHT
or NNPDF. But the real problem boils
down again to the value, to this left column, when we look at the value of the Chan-Quark mass. that's been used in effect. Yeah? Because kinematically, what data is driving you to is a low value of the charm probe mass, and those fits, they use a value of the pole charm probe mass of something between 1.25 and 1.3 GeV. And for a pole mass, this is basically not compatible with the world average. Right? So the world average for a running mass at the scale of the mass is 1.27 GeV. Yeah? And so when we fit the running mass for the charm, you see we get out something like 125 with a margin of plus 50 minus 30 MeV from the experimental uncertainties. Yeah? And so this is the real issue. This is, you come up with a very flavor number scheme, you want to fit the gluon, everything else, and your scheme is sort of fixed, and then there is this one additional parameter which, in order to achieve a good fit, you're forced to tune to a value
which is not consistent with other measurements.
I'm confused. The, say, 1.25 there for MMHD, is that the pole mass? Or the
it's the pole mass, yeah.
So that's not the same. It's not supposed to be the same.
No, no, yeah, but you see, if you look at how should you go from a charm quark mass in the MS-bar scheme of 1.25 GeV, how should you go to the pole scheme? Yeah? And so at one loop, you should use a value of 1.47 GeV. At two loop, you should use a value of 1.67 GeV. And at three loop, you should use something close to 2 GeV. And then at the four loop, you should use something like 2.4 GeV. This is just a renowned non-ambiguity here. It's just telling you the pole mass is not a good scheme and the series is non-converging. Yeah? But any of the values that you're using here, for instance, the two loops, yeah, if you're using these verbal flavor number schemes to NLO accuracy, yeah, you should be using here a value of the pole mass of 1.67 at least, yeah, and not 1.25. So this is not compatible.
And now we can look at
how does this propagate to the Higgs cross section, to come back to the initial question.
Can I ask you, because I mean, the MS-bar mass is also a bit dangerous. What you said before, that the Q squared values from which you get most sensitivity are actually close to 3 or 5 GeV.
The low spin is at 2.5 GeV. Yeah.
So
we are still above, but we are.
Worth trying one of these.
This is a good point here, actually, to go back to these fits and try some PS mass or something like this as an alternative, simply to check.
What about higher twist contributions?
We always account for higher twist contributions, and they are essential, not necessarily for charm, but for alpha S, because then you're fitting light flavor inclusive DAS data in the region of X for a Q squared radio sensitivity. So I have some backup slides. So for the Higgs cross section, this is summarized in a table here for MMHT. So they provided a fit of alpha S and the pole mass, and they ran it through their fit machinery. So chose those ranges for the pole mass of the charm, starting from 1.15 going up to 1.55. This is the best fit for alpha S, which they are getting. Yeah, and this is the values of chi-squared, which they are reporting. So you see that the best fit in terms of chi-squared, which they are getting for this pole mass of 1.25, gives them the best fit for alpha S of 1167. And if I run this and I compute a cross-section for the Higgs production at the LHC, I would get 40.9 roughly. Yeah? This is the best fit which they get from looking at the data. However, due to the fact that they chose to tune in the global fit which they are publishing, to tune the charm quark mass to a value of 1.40, they pay a penalty in chi-squared. Alpha S becomes larger, and of course the Higgs cross section rises. Yeah? And so at least the difference between here and here, which is something of the order of 1.5 picobar, this is an entirely an effect of tuning
your global fit. Yeah? And this at the level of uncertainties we're discussing at the moment.
Yeah, with the 24.16 to 24.17.
Sorry?
I would compare 42.17.
Yeah. Of course, you can look at this column here. Yeah. Yeah. This is 0.6. Yeah. But you should look at the correlation with alpha s, because you see when you freeze the one parameter, there is a correlation between the Chalmers and alpha s.
Yeah, but you have to say in the third column then.
If I assume alpha s is God given, if I study the effect of tuning the Chalmers, I get a very small difference.
I'm just telling you the numbers. This is what you get out there. Yeah?
So I should compare 40.89 with 41.56 or 42.17.
The philosophy here is never that alpha s is God given. It's not taken from other data. It's always put together with.
Sorry?
But in reality, it's a number.
And if you want to elaborate on the end
This fit value, that's only from the Hera-Charm data, right?
No, this is coming from the global fit. So we basically run a global fit, and the additional parameter which they vary in their fit is the Charm-Borg mass. Yeah? Then they allow for alpha s to be fitted instead of being fixed. Yeah? And this is the result.
So essentially what you're seeing here is a vestige of the fact that the DRS data preferred lower values of alpha s.
This is what we're seeing here, yes, that if you have a free fit of alpha s, you see that even for heavier charm masses, they stay below the world average here, yeah? So they are different from what they finally assume as a fixed value for alpha s. And you are seeing that you have a strong sensitivity and a correlation between charm and alpha s.
So the issue actually is not so much the charm mass, but rather the value of alpha s that you choose.
No, not really, because if they go to higher values of the charm mass, they pay a big penalty in chi-squared, you know, in your description.
Yeah, but you're only showing the chi-squared for the Hera data, if I understand it right. I should also look at the chi-squared for all the other data which goes into the fit.
Right. So this is what we don't have in this table. So there is no, at least from the publication which they have, there is no information available as to how the chi-squared changes with respect to the other fits. But we're currently working at putting this in as well, because there have been arguments put forward that the inclusive data is much more important, and so we wanted to check this as well. Yeah? Anyway, this is the most sensitive data set which tests this variable flavor number scheme, which is argued to be important, or an important distinction, or important in doing precision phenomenology, whatever. And these are the residual uncertainties or tunes that are in there. Yeah?
So I'm still a little bit unsure on how to make this table. So
yeah?
If I go back, I would say that if I go from one column to the other, I see pretty much the variation which you get in from changing the value of the alpha strong. And then if I stay in the same column, especially if I stay in the very last column, I will see only the effect of the transport mass, because the alpha strong is fixed.
It's closer to each other, like 1170 to 1180. Yeah.
So I would say that once you fix alpha strong, the variation is not so big in the context of the charm mass.
Yeah.
And then if I take a fixed value for the charm mass, for example, where you put the 125. I see that the best fit is a much lower value, and it gives me a much lower cross-section, so the jump I have between the third and the fourth column is from the increasing alpha strong, which is what we were saying before also for the fit values, for the values you get with the different PDR sets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. I mean, I'm saying it's correlated, and there is... this is all we can do outside just using published results, yeah? So basically it would be up to those groups to make a more detailed analysis.
of the issue. We're just saying these are the differences that we're seeing. All we can do is confront it with the chi-square values with respect to data.
But then I would say that this big 11% discrepancy you are observing earlier in the Hooke's section is mostly due to the different fit of the upper strong.
I would argue it's a sum of several effects. It's a sum of several effects, and you have to look a bit in detail into the individual bits and pieces. I would also say that alpha S certainly has the largest contribution. This is certainly clear. But I wanted to also to say that the treatment of the precise formulation of this verbal flavor number scheme that gives you a variation in alpha S, which you finally get out, which is at least of the size of the uncertainties which are reported and not accounted for. Because if you take an alpha S value of 1180, with an uncertainty in the end of plus minus 0.15, then here you're already at the edge of what you're doing.
Okay, so we see similar trend when looking at NMP data,
so there is not so much data available. So they did a Chalmers variation once a couple of years ago, varying the Chalmers in a range between square root of 2 and 1.7 GeV. And you see the same trend in chi-squared. As you go to heavier Chalmerses, your chi-squared becomes worse, and your Higgs cross-section rises. This is for a fixed alpha S, and then lately, this is what brings me back to this remarkable agreement, on the Higgs cross-section lately, they've been choosing a smaller value of alpha S fixed in their fit, and they also lowered the Chalmers value numerically to this value of 1.275. And this, of course, is designed to bring the X cross-section down between what they had before in NLP of 2.3 and the new version 3.0.
It's 2% variation, not 11%.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is just telling you again the shift between the shift that you just have when choosing the input parameters, because there has been between this fit and this fit there has been no new data added that would justify this change. Error-charm data has been the same. So this is just again an effect of tuning.
Okay, I'm halfway through the talk, but I guess I have an hour. I prepared some more slides, so I basically have some more stuff on basically WZ boson production. This is if anybody's interested in light flavor separation.
And I can, if you have questions on strangeness, I can also explain it to you. And then I had some comments on the gluon PDF at small x, if you're interested, or I can talk something about the strong coupling cons. Maybe this is the last thing I would, since we discussed it, I would come to. I skip the history because you probably know this. This is a compilation of strong coupling cons determinations at NLRO from PDF fits over the years, starting in 2001. With the arrival of first approximate NLRO evolution equations. And you see in the table that all the values which you get there are pretty much on the lower side compared to the world average. And some of them
have
some theory issues as well. Other measurements I skip. So this is the alpha S values that go into the Higgs cross section. I discussed it already, so mostly what people do is they assume a value of 1180 at NLRO. If you do a fit, you get something between 1136 or 1132 and 1160 here for these global fits.
So there is you're on the lower side.
And the difference is between getting, say, an alpha S value of 1132 or fitted alpha S values from these loops here, like MMPDF21 they did once, or MSTW, or MMHT,
again results in the way you do your theory treatment here. Basically, in this column, I mark whether it's strictly NNLO or not, and this bracket around the yes is that all these numbers have been determined again with using JET data, which is only available to NLO, and non-scale variations included, and no theory uncertainties to account for this. So this is one issue. But the more important issues is if you look now at the DAS part of the data, whether you include target mass corrections in your DIS cross-section, whether you include higher twist effects, parameterized in additive form like this, or whether you account for error correlations between the different DIS experiments. If you switch a no to a yes, or a yes to a no in these tables, we can basically reproduce from our approach, we can reproduce shifts of the alpha S values in the direction to those values discovered here. And so for instance, if we switch off error correlation between different DAS sets, then we can come closer to what MSDW is doing. Higher twist is what distinguishes us from NNPDF, for instance, and all these effects can be quantified, and they account for the shift which is at the level of the experimental uncertainties of the order 3 to 4 sigma. So it's significant again, and it's how you treat your theory.
So to what extent are these power corrections controlled?
Basically, you make a parameterization in terms of some polynomial in X, suppressed by Q squared, as you would get it from the OPE. You could even go to twist. You can go to twist 4, go to twist 6. You see the data is not precise enough to constrain this one here, but you get a non-zero result here in a certain region of X for your higher twist.
This is predominantly a large X.
This is located at large X, so in a region between, say, minus 2 to 1. More commonly around minus 1 to 1. And you can check it. Alternatively, what you can do is you can make a Q squared min cut so that you try to cut away the region and the data which is sensitive to higher twist. And in this way, you can cross check your analysis. Yeah? Okay.
So, once you pick up from the data, you look at it after the effect, you check the next form.
Sure.
So, what's the largest higher twist effect?
I have it in the next slide, yeah. So, so this is the chi-squared plots that we get for alpha S, and the only other chi-squared plots are from NNPDF, and this is illustrating the effect, yeah. This is just from a recent update which we are preparing and which has been reported at the DIS conference. This is alpha S determinations from DIS data over the years. So you start here with BCDMS and with slack data, and they are localized at large Q, as low Q squared and large X. So these are the data sets which are mostly affected by higher twist corrections. Yeah? You see that you can make two types of fits. You can make you can fix higher twist, or you can fit it, or you can set it to zero. Yeah. And you see there is a shift in alpha S of about 1 sigma upwards. If you don't include higher twist, then it's even more prominently observed for slack data, yeah, where a fitted higher twist gives you an alpha S value of 1150. Yeah, and if you just set higher twist to zero, the slack data alpha S value moves way up. Yeah.
What I meant is something else. So yeah. You have an observable which you fit. After the fit, this is has a contribution from the higher twist that you parameterized.
Yeah.
It should remain small for any observable, otherwise you don't control what you have been done. So for every sort of data point, you should sort of check whether the T4 contribution remains correct.
We have in one paper, we have some pools for this data where we fit it with and without higher twist, and when we quantify it at the level of the observer.
So you're seeing small shifts, but I don't have to plot in the talk here. I can show you in the paper. Yeah? So it is generally a small correction. It can become important in regions of low Q scale.
And what happens to your fintech, the other thing you mentioned, you sequentially throw out the lowest Q squared data.
If we make cuts in Q, sure. Then what we see is we lose statistical power because we are throwing away data. But what we typically see is that the value of alpha S remains stable. This is another check that we're doing here. So we vary the Q square min cut up to say typically 20 or so, or the W square cut and then vary mass energy up to 12.5 and then we check. So this is another variation. Okay, then you see it over here. SLAC and BCDMS data, they are rather old, so you can also question about question that is experimental uncertainty. NMC data still also gives you a larger value of alpha S compared to HERA, but due to the kinematics, it's less sensitive to higher twist. This is why the two variants of the fit are close together, and the same we observe for HERA data. So HERA 1 and HERA 2 data, HERA 2 data has finally been published in middle of last year, and then you can do the same. And the interesting thing is that now with the HERA 2 data included, we see there is a upward move of the value of alpha S of the order of roughly 1 sigma in the experimental uncertainty. Yeah? So this is the new result that if we use this combined fit and combined data in a global fit, then we would be getting an alpha S value of roughly 1150, a little bit lower than the global fit. Yeah? This is the effect of the new data. But combining all the DIS information available, you see that you're always well below the world average that is degraded from the PDG.
Okay, yeah, so that was it.
Remind me how big the new error is, because they enlarged the error, right, in the newest? Oh, no, see, that's the 2016, so that's enlarged. No, I'm saying is the PDG value. I think the error enlarged
is,
the PDG.
Yeah, this is the 2016 PDG.
Yeah, result, yeah. Okay, yeah.
That brings me to the end. I tried to explain to you a little bit what kind of theory assumptions go into the various BF fits, what kind of consequences this has for cross-section predictions, and that when you use any PDFs, it's a good idea to always read the fine print. Thanks.
Thank you. It's a very interesting talk. Ready for some discussion, but it's time for more. Yes.
Do you have some plots about just cross sections or DT bar cross sections, and how basically what you've described is fits to the PDFs, which are largely driven by DIS. Okay, and while you are not using things like DT bar and jet data, so how well do you describe those data?
Yeah, so I don't have a plot on DT bar data in here. I have a plot on single top cross sections in here. That
is sensitive to the flavor separation. This is interesting because there we also have complete NNLO results. And this can be measured to high precision. And so you can even form ratios between top and anti-top. And then in this ratio, a lot of experimental systematics drops out, and you're only limited by statistics. Yeah? And this is the yellow band is statistics, the green band is combined with experimental systematics from Atlas and CMS. And so this really has the potential to become a standard candle measurement for PDFs for the light flavor sector. Now for TT bar,
I'm more interested in the gluon.
Okay, for TT bar, you are sensitive predominantly to the gluon, yeah, and to alpha S again. And there, when we include the data, I don't have a plot here, but we've done it in a recent update. We include all the cross-section data which is available, and we let the top quark mass be the free parameter in the fit, and then we get a consistent fit. And since the top quark mass is only then constrained from this data, we get a value of the top quark mass in the MS bar scheme of 161 GeV roughly, with uncertainties. If you translate this to a pole mass for the top at two loop order,
we'd be talking roughly 170.5, 171 GeV roughly. Yeah? So this is, if you're asking for the consistency, how can we consistently incorporate
okay, which means that your cross-section, I mean, if I take the value of around 173 GeV, you are actually under...
exactly. So if you fix the top pole mass at a value of, say, 173 GeV, and we run it, then with our nominal fit, we would be below the data. By how much, I cannot tell by heart, but probably by 1.5 sigma or so. Huh?
And what about jet cross-sections?
Jet cross-sections we have tried. The experimenters always try. So when they use this to, like CMS jets at NLO, typically, by and large, you could say they have data, and we are about 15-20% below, depending on the PT kinematics, what you're looking at. Yeah? So we would argue that we'd like to see the NNLO K factor in order to close the gap to be of the order of 10-15 whatever percent. Results from the blue channel that have been reported by Nigel a couple of years ago indicate, and also from soft approximations in the large PT region, indicate this can well be the case. Yeah. But we would like definitely very much to see the NNLO corrections for jets and hydro production in order to make this agreement or discrepancy quantitative.
Could you go back to the Rubik's cross-section in the very beginning, the slide with the different predictions? So now that we discussed all the different things we should worry about, so the difference, where does it mainly now come from? What is it?
Okay, I don't have the table here where I run all the same, all the PDFs, say with 1180 or 1150, say as an alpha S value. And then, as we discussed, makes a significant part, shifts significantly the central values. Yeah? This is something to certainly take into account, and but it doesn't make up for the full discrepancy. So if I run all the sets with 1180, yeah, us and JR and others, then we don't really, we would overshoot, for instance, and they would overshoot a bit. If we run everybody with 1150, we sort of come closer together, but there still remain differences.
Even if you take into account all the uncertainties that you talked about, schemes, having higher twist, not higher twist, everything.
Oh, this, I mean, in a general way, making a full error budget, breaking down this range in terms of all the individual effects that I described before, this we haven't done. So I just told you, like, a major part comes from alpha S, smaller parts come from char mass effects, higher twist we could quantify as well, but we haven't.
As I told you, when we did the comparisons for them, cube, for the different sets that entered the, let's say, PDF feed, we saw that there was this very nice agreement. When we used your set, of course, we rolled over. And then we had this funny thing, CT14 gives also one set that your value of alpha is strong, so we run it, but we cannot compute the PDF error. If that would be interesting for us to see, because, of course, the prediction was much lower. There are points which are much closer, but of course, if we cannot compute the PDF error, we cannot assess. That was our way to gauge a little bit how much this was going to be due to the different value of alpha strong. Because for CT14, we can also make the comparison of the 118 with the other sets that it will fit.
So typically, what we see when we vary alpha S, when we vary alpha S in the range by keeping it fixed, and then we look at the uncertainties, they don't change so much between, like, the PDF uncertainties themselves, they don't change so much between 1180 and 1130 or so, because this is largely coming from the uncertainties of the data, and they don't change so much over, I mean, they don't widely oscillate when moving alpha S in a small range. So if you have an uncertainty for CT14, which is that size here at
at the nominal value of alpha s equal to 80, then it would pretty much stay the same when they vary alpha s to lower values, I would guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I will try to play around with this thing, because I've got the plot in front of me, and it looks like there is a discrepancy, but it's within the PDF plus alpha strong error of them.
Yeah.
I just tell you
that if this is the final value, or sort of this, if this is the order of magnitude uncertainty which ends up in the Higgs yellow report, it's probably a bit small.
Is it easy to understand why some of these, is there an obvious reason why some of the PDFs are sort of backed with two different errors? Do they just use less data, or is there?
This is due to this inflated chi-square criterion which they're using in the statistics. So that is basically designed to artificially inflate the uncertainties. This is why they are having very large uncertainties.
Inconsistent data sets.
They enlarge the chi-square penalty to allow for fitting inconsistent data sets, and this is why they generally accept large uncertainties.
In some of them, I mean, there's factors of five difference in the uncertainties.
Yeah.
This is another important issue that I think there was a KITP workshop here in
2004 where this has been discussed extensively, whether this would be a good prescription or not to do. Yeah. And initially, MSTW or the predecessors, they also had the chi-square value of 100. But they slowly reduced it because obviously they can control the data sets a bit better or the consistency of those. Eventually, I think we should abandon this altogether, because we should only be fitting consistent data sets.
So what does consistent data set mean? Is that the data itself is inconsistent, or that the results of the fit that you get?
I show you a nice example, which is interesting for theorists.
Data is often enough inconsistent, right?
So we have W and Z boson production data, and we have this constraints the light flavors, and we have this nice data from LHCb, and this covers a certain rapidity range,
and we wanted to use this data in order to fit the U and the D flavors, and then they unfortunately had applied QED corrections to their data in order to account for final state radiations. And in their two publications, they ran two different versions of how to estimate this. And the one they used, and the other one they used, is Photos Monte Carlo by Wongs. Yeah? And they got these results as a function of rapidity. So you see corrections of the order of 1% or so. And in the newer result, they used, I think, the average of Herwig and Fithia simulations. Yeah, with a certain statistics, and they got these results for the QED corrections as a function of rapidity. Yeah. So
is the way out to do QED corrections in the PDFs as well?
We can do it, but I'm just telling you now, if they apply these corrections, they artificially shift this one data point here by a large amount due to the way they're mistreating the QED corrections, and then you can actually see it here. Yeah. If we do the fit, then we should fit a data point which has been shifted way off due to insufficient analysis of data, we would see. Yeah? And now what did we do? Finally, we decided to discard this data point. Yeah?
If what is on the x-axis here?
Sorry?
What is on the x-axis here?
This is rapidity here. Yeah, so we finally made a cut, we excluded it. We could have included it, but at the price of having a penalty of 10 units in chi-square for a low number of data points. So this is what I mean with inconsistent data sets. And just simply, if you consider it valuable enough, you can toss data at individual bins, but more generally, you would simply discard them.
It's always a good message that experimentalists shouldn't mistreat their data. It should be as raw as possible.
So I just want to say that Pavanatovsky will be here later, and maybe that's an opportunity since he's on the CT collaboration to talk more about fixed versus variable.
Yes, definitely.
So maybe we can have an informal discussion for people who are interested in variables. into this. Okay, great. Thank you very much.